We have a lot to do today. We are finishing the book of Joshua. We are on the last chapter. And this chapter is a very interesting chapter. It raises a lot of questions. And I don't want to read through the whole chapter, but we're going to follow through the chapter. And I'll point out certain things and ask a lot of questions. And then I'm going to present two very different interpretations that each one answers a lot of the questions. One interpretation, I'll warn you, is way out there, and I think I'll present that one first, and then the second one is a little bit more traditional, okay? These are not my interpretations. These are interpretations I heard from the people who came up with them, and anyway, it's very interesting. So just to remind you, chapter 23, we already have the speech that Joshua made to the nation, and it was a very standard kind of speech, but summarizing the miracles that the nation perceived as they were capturing the land and warning them about the necessity of continuing to keep the commandments, to follow the Torah, not to follow other gods, warning them of the temptation and the problems that could come to them if they do abandon God and go forward. And reminding them of the covenant between them and God. And it's it's a good speech. It's a very, let's say, the kind of speech we would expect Joshua to make before he dies as he's concluding this whole enterprise that he has done and in bringing the nation into the land. The problem is that in chapter 24, we have yet another speech of Joshua's. And so the question is, why a second speech? We were perfectly happy with the speech in chapter 23. What is it that the speech in chapter 24 gives us and the other one didn't? But beyond that, there's some very real questions that this chapter presents, okay? So first of all, we have at the beginning, Joshua gathers all the tribes of Israel to Shechem. Now that already is a very interesting place. We don't know about any, we learned about the tabernacle, which is sitting in Shiloh. And we know that that was a previous gathering space for the tribes and from which, you know, Joshua spoke to them earlier and gave them the direction of how to conquer the land. In chapter 23, it doesn't mention a particular place where he gathers them, but in chapter 24, they're suddenly in Shechem. Again, that's a question. It calls to the elders of Israel, to their heads, to their judges, to their police, their officers, and they all come and stand before God, okay? And then Joshua, and here it's very interesting. The first chapter, the first verse, he talks about calling the elders of Israel, the leaders, and et cetera. And then in verse 2, it says, and then Joshua said to all the people. Now, the word here in Hebrew is ha'am, all the people, or the nation, okay? And this is an unusual word. We have not seen that word beforehand. If you look in Joshua, whenever he's talking to everybody, he usually says he's talking to Israel, or he's talking to the children of Israel, or he's talking to the tribes of Israel. We haven't yet seen this word. He's speaking to the nation, to the people, okay? So that is something to keep in mind. I wouldn't say that's a major question, but it is something that can indicate that there's a little bit something different going on. And then he goes on, and very timely that we're doing this chapter here, because the next few verses are quoted in the Passover Haggadah, okay? And he says them as follows, so says the Lord, the God of Israel. In olden times, your forefathers, Terah, the father of Abraham and father of Nahor, lived beyond the Euphrates and worshiped other gods. But I took your father Abraham from beyond the Euphrates and led him through the whole land of Canaan and multiplied his offspring. I gave him Isaac, and to Isaac I gave Jacob and Esau. I gave Esau the hill country of Seir as his possession, while Jacob and his children went down to Egypt. Then I sent Moses and Aaron. I plagued Egypt with the wonders that I wrought in their midst, after which I freed you. I freed your fathers from Egypt, and you came to the sea. So first of all, let me just stop and go back for a second. Why suddenly going back to Terah? If we know anything about the Bible, beginning in chapter 12, God seeks Abraham and tells Abraham to separate from his family. Terah should no longer be relevant. This is the first time since that point, since Genesis 12, that anyone has gone back and referred to ancestors of Israel as including Terah. Terah is a pagan, he's an idol worshiper, and he's the person that Abraham is separated from. Why are we suddenly bringing up Terah? So that's another question. Okay, and then we begin to have, beginning in verse 5, we have the whole story of Egypt, and then how they were enslaved, and God rescued them from the Egypt, and then he brings them to the wilderness. And then he says in verse 8, I brought you to the land of the Amorites who lived beyond the Jordan. They gave battle to you, but I delivered them into your hands. I annihilated them for you, and you took possession of their land. Okay, now here we're talking about, when it talks about the land of the Amorites beyond the Jordan, we're talking about that section of the land on the eastern part of the Jordan when it is still under Moses. Thereupon, Balak, son of Zippor, the king of Moab, made ready to attack Israel. So we have here a description of that story back in the book of Numbers about Balak, who tries to curse the nation, and it doesn't work. Okay, but I refuse to listen to Balaam. We had to bless you unless I saved you from him. Okay, fine. It's, again, a little strange in this whole situation when Joshua is giving this whole study. Why mention Balak and Balaam? Like, why is that relevant at this point so many years later? Then you cross the Jordan, you came to Jericho, and here we have what we would expect, you know, a mention of the various nations that here in the land of Canaan, Joshua has helped them, you know, fight or whatever. And then we have the following in verse 12. And here is an interesting issue of translation. In my English, it says, I sent a plague ahead of you. The word in Hebrew is sirah. Sirah is not a plague. Now, there is one minority interpretation that says it's referring to a type of a plague. It certainly doesn't mean plague. But most commentaries say this refers to a kind of a wasp or a hornet, okay? And this particular thing about sending this wasp or hornet, it is that we find in a few different places that we've already met in advance. Let me just finish reading this verse. I sent a hornet ahead of you, and it drove them out before you, just like the two Amorite kings, not by your sword or by your bow. I have given you a land for which you did not labor and towns which you did not build, and you have settled in them, and you are enjoying vineyards and olive groves which you did not plant. Okay? So you have this idea that God has sent something as a supernatural assistance to the nation to conquer and settle the land. So what is this hornet that we're talking about? So first of all, if you go back and you look at Exodus 23, Exodus 23, verse 27 and 28, you will see that we have the first mention of this idea. I will send forth my terror before you. I will throw into panic all the people among whom you come, and I will make all your enemies turn tail before you. I will send a hornet ahead of you, and it shall drive out before you the Hivites, the Canaanites, and the Hittites. So this is when God is first promising to the nation of Israel, very close to the Exodus from Egypt, right after the revelation at Sinai, and he's promising them, this is how you're going to capture the land. Again, this is a supernatural kind of thing. Some kind of hornet is going to help with this whole thing. And again, the same idea is mentioned in Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 20. The Lord your God will also send a hornet against them until those who are left in hiding perish before you. What is this hornet? So one interpretation is literally it's a hornet. It's some kind of something that you get the impression would think about a hornet or a wasp that comes in and it creates fear, it distracts, and perhaps there's this idea either literally or figuratively of something that will sow fear within the hearts of the armies so that when the nation comes in under Joshua, it has made it that much easier for them to conquer them because they're already in a sense of distraction or fear. There was a very interesting commentary that I saw that a hornet is actually, they found, I guess, in archaeology, ruins, remains from Egypt at this time, that actually the hornet is a symbol of Egypt. And so they found it, I think, on crown, certain crowns or headgear or something, or pictures of a king that would have this picture of a wasp or a hornet on this on the symbol of the king of Egypt. And then the interpretation is, if we think about geopolitically what's going on at this time, during the time of the Exodus, Egypt is not only a very powerful country, but it is the empire that also controls the land of Canaan. And there's some documents, they're called the El Amarna documents, that are from the time period right prior to the entrance of the nation into the land of Canaan, where we see all these different principalities, the different kingdoms that we read about in the book of Joshua that are all conquered. They're these little city-states, you know, kings of small areas, that these are the people that we've encountered, that they're writing letters back and forth to Egypt at that time, where it's called a vassal state relationship, where the empire is Egypt, and each of these kings have a level of autonomy, but ultimately they owe a certain degree of allegiance as well as tax money to Egypt as the overriding controlling empire. So this is a situation just before we came into Canaan. So the interpretation is saying that through this arrangement, Egypt has already significantly weakened the kings of Canaan, so that there's a certain preparation. God has said, I've already sent the wasp before you. I have sent Egypt before you to create a certain level of desolation or dependence or lack of strength in the Canaanites, which then makes it easier for the nation to conquer. So that's just an interesting comment, I think, about what that means. Okay. Now we're on verse 14. Now therefore revere the Lord and serve him with undivided loyalty. Remove the gods that your forefathers served beyond the Euphrates and in Egypt and serve the Lord. Now this is a very unusual kind of thing. What do you mean remove the gods? What we've had until now, both in Deuteronomy and in Joshua, particularly in chapter 23, we have a warning to the nation of Israel, not remove your gods because you already have pagan gods behind you, but a warning to them, now that you're in Canaan and you're settling, don't become influenced by the Canaanite nations and take their gods. This, though, seems to say that they already have gods. What do you mean they have pagan gods? What do you mean to remove them? Now, this reminds us of a similar kind of, almost the same language, by the way, in Genesis. In Genesis 35, we meet Jacob as he is coming back into the land of Israel. And he says to his family, everybody around him, this is chapter 35, Genesis 35, verse 4. They gave to Jacob, verse 2. So Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, rid yourselves of the alien gods in your midst, purify yourselves and change your clothes. And then we learn afterwards in verse 4 that that's what they do. Now, what does this mean? Get rid of these alien gods. Again, you think of Jacob. He certainly was not worshiping gods. He married these two women, Rachel and Leah. They were clearly God-fearing women. They're not worshiping idols. Who has idols in his midst? Well, a clue may be where he says, he said to his household and all who were with him. It could be this is referring to servants and all kinds of others that kind of attach themselves to him. And he has to get rid of them. Get rid of the idols. But I will also remind you, and this becomes very significant, this chapter 35 comes right after the destruction of the city of Shechem, okay? And this destruction of the city of Shechem, of course, is a result of this fellow Shechem, that's also his name. He's the prince of that city, and he abducts Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, rapes her, and then comes to Jacob and says, you know, I like her, I want to marry her. And then the sons, Simeon and Levi, enter into a subterfuge where they say to Shechem and his father Hamor, not a problem, we're happy to intermarry, all of us, very nice. But in order to do that, you have to circumcise yourself. And the understanding there being not just a physical circumcision, but some level of become part of our faith, become part of who we are. And of course, this is a subterfuge because they agree and they circumcise themselves. And a few days later, when they are at their weakest point, Simeon and Levi go in and the brothers, and they just massacre the men, or at least most of the men in the city. It's a terrible, terrible thing what they have done, terrible. And Jacob, of course, is very disturbed about the whole thing. But it is possible that as a result of this thing, I don't know, maybe Jacob has extra people that he's gathered to him that are bringing with him pagan gods. I don't know. We'll get back to that later, but I'm just raising this right now as a question. Okay, verse 15. Or if you are both loath to serve the Lord, choose this day which one you're going to serve, the gods that your forefathers served beyond the Euphrates, or those of the Amorites in whose land you are settled. But I and my household will serve the Lord. Again, this is very bizarre. What do you mean the nation of Israel has to choose? The nation of Israel has already chosen. They've entered into two different covenants with God. In Sinai, they entered into a covenant with God at Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. They've already chosen. That's already committed. What is this all of a sudden? He's saying, choose between a pagan God and the God of Israel. It's a little strange. Okay. And then it says in reply, the people declared, you know, and they commit themselves to abandon any, you know, they're not going to serve foreign gods, but they will serve, for it was the Lord our God who brought us and our fathers up from the land of Egypt, the house of bondage. And it talks about all the miracles and et cetera. We too will serve the Lord, for he is our God. Okay. And then Joshua then repeats again. He said, you will not be able to serve the Lord, for he is a holy God. He is a jealous God. He will not forgive your transgressions. If you forsake the Lord and serve alien gods, he will turn and deal harshly for them. So again, they repeat, no. We know what we're doing. We're serving the Lord. We're not serving any alien gods. And then again, Joshua says to them, then put away the alien gods that you have among you. Direct your hearts to the Lord your God. And the people declare to Joshua, we will serve none but the Lord our God, and we will obey none by him. Okay. And then we have here a covenant. On that day at Shechem, I'm in verse 25. On that day at Shechem, Joshua made a covenant for the people, and he made a fixed rule for them. Joshua recorded all this in a book of divine instruction. He took a great stone and set it up at the front of the oak in the sacred precinct, or actually it says in the temple. In Hebrew, it's Mikdash, in the temple of the Lord, or in the sacred space, however you want to. It's usually defined as temple, but maybe it's a little broader than that. But what kind of an oak? First of all, this under an oak, it sounds, an oak where there's a sacred space, it sounds like the description of a pagan temple, if you think about it. A pagan temple, an oak, would have been one of the symbols of worship in pagan, you know, an Elah, this kind of oak or whatever, is referred to many times as one of the symbols of worship for pagan worship for the Canaanites. What kind of temple for the Lord is there with an oak? We don't know of any temple in Shechem. We've never heard about that. We know of a temple in, or a tabernacle in Shiloh. What is this all of a sudden? Okay. And anyway, they set the stone, see this very stone, shall be a witness against us, for it heard all the words that the Lord spoke to us, and etc. And that's the end of the story. And then everybody disperses. Okay. And the end of this is really just about the end. We'll deal with that in a minute. Okay. So as you can see, there's some troubling questions that we have raised here. What is this covenant? Why Shechem? When exactly does this speech take place? Why a double speech? Why are some of these issues in this speech so odd, you know, that we have not seen before? What kind of pagan gods would these people have in their midst already that they would have to get rid of them? Okay, so now I'm going to present you with a more unusual interpretation. This is an interpretation that was given by a rabbi named Yoel Binun, who is a very well-known Bible scholar here in Israel. And he says as follows. He says Shechem is not like the rest of Israel or the rest of Canaan. He says, if you look in chapter 12, okay, remember Joshua 12, we have that whole list of kings that were conquered. Shechem is not there. There is not a single mention anywhere in the book of Joshua of the capture and conquest of Shechem. Now, Shechem is not just a little town. or a village somewhere. It is a major city. It has been since the time of Abraham, and it continues to be to this time. And later, we meet Shechem beyond as well. And we meet Shechem in the book of Judges. We meet Shechem in the book of Kings. It remains a big city. How is it that the conquest of Shechem is not mentioned? Okay. So what he does, with this interesting, very interesting description, it goes back to a number of references that we have in other places in the Bible. First of all, in Genesis 34, we have the whole story that I just mentioned to you about this uneasy alliance that takes place between the children of Jacob and the people of Shechem, where they go through some sort of circumcision, maybe even some sort of conversion ceremony, only to be betrayed afterwards, and many of them murdered. Okay. The theory is that at that point in time, number one, maybe not, it says all the males were murdered, but it's very common in the Bible to have a certain exaggeration when you're talking about things like battles. The numbers are often inflated. Everybody was killed. You know, it's not always that precise. It's more there to create an impression. It's very possible that the remaining, I mean, maybe the whole family of Shechem was killed. All the important people were killed. But this idea is saying there would have been people left in Shechem, and maybe some of them actually connected with the children of Israel. Maybe they adopted the faith in seriousness or semi-seriousness. And again, we see Jacob right after this telling his family, get rid of your idols. Who are these people? This could very well indicate there were already some hangers-on from the city of Shechem that connect themselves to Jacob in this way. And these are the people who have to rid themselves of their idols. The theory therefore goes that in the city of Shechem, from the time of Jacob and through until this time of Joshua, there remains people who have a sense of kinship, a sense of alliance with the nation of Israel, and therefore they don't have to be conquered because they are very happy to ally themselves with Israel. And it's very possible they've already believed to some degree in the God of Israel, but maybe they have some kind of, we found this, you know, some kind of joint belief. Yeah, we believe in the God of Israel and we'll pray to them, but maybe we still have our pagan gods because we want to cover our bases, you know, and it's a city with a different status, okay, a different type of people. And another indication of this very unusual situation is a verse in the book of Chronicles that I'm sure you will agree is extremely difficult to understand. First book of Chronicles, chapter 7, verse 20. And this is part, of course, you know how the book of Chronicles is. It goes through all these genealogies. And this one is talking about Ephraim, the son of Joseph. Okay, this is going way back. What does it say here? The sons of Ephraim, Shutelah, his son Bered, his son Tahat, his son El-Ada, his son Tahat. Two Tahats. I don't know. Two sons have the same name, whatever. His son Zavad, his son Shutelah, his son Ezer, and Elad. Okay, list of people who are the sons of Ephraim. Now listen to this little mini story. The men of Gat, born in the land, killed them because they had gone down to take their cattle. And Ephraim, their father, mourned many days, and his brothers came to comfort him. What is going on? Remember, Ephraim and Manasseh were not born in Israel. This cannot have taken place before the nation of Israel the family of Israel comes down to Egypt, because they are born of Joseph from an Egyptian woman, and they have always lived in Egypt. So at some point, the sons, and it could be grandsons, some people who are descendants of Ephraim, okay, go back to the land of Israel, and they go there because they want to, I don't know, take their cattle, raise their cattle, something with cattle. And while they're there, they're attacked by people from Gat who were native to the land, unlike the children of Ephraim. And then it says, Ephraim mourned them many days, and the brothers come to. When did this happen? Well, it's fairly clear that this would have to have happened sometime during the enslavement of the children of Israel in Egypt. Because it's the children or the grandchildren of Ephraim, and that's the time frame. Okay. Now there's a tradition that said that there were people from Ephraim that decided, okay, they made a calculation, the time of the enslavery in Egypt is over, let's go. And without an exodus and without God giving them command on their own, they go to Israel. And when they get there, they're massacred. At least some of them are massacred. And this is a tradition told in the Midrash. I'm not sure what we make of it, but it's certainly a very ancient tradition that this is something that had happened. Okay. So another theory, I mean, Shechem is in the tribe of Ephraim. That's where it is. So there's another theory that says there was some remnant from the children of Ephraim that came out of Egypt, that survived, that stayed in Ephraim and just stayed there until the rest of the nation came out and met them in Shechem. So you have two different theories coming from biblical stories as to why Shechem might have been a different kind of place, a place that they didn't have to conquer, a place that had some kind of quasi-relationship with Israel already. According to this theory, then, again, I'm still quoting from Yoel Binun, what he is saying then is what Joshua did is he gathered everybody in Shechem, all the tribes of Israel. But then in verse 2, when it says, and then Joshua spoke to the people, he's talking about a motley group of people, the people who were in Shechem, as well as the people from Israel. And he's basically saying to the people of Shechem, okay, guys, now is the time to decide. You cannot maintain a quasi relationship with Israel. You're either in or you're out. You either believe in the God of Israel or you believe in the pagan gods. You cannot have it both ways. And what happens in this story, of course, is that they decide, no, we're with Israel. Now, again, this is a bit of an odd kind of interpretation. You can accept it or reject it as you like, but I will just add to say Shechem remains a difficult place. Those of you who continue with us studying in Joshua, when we talk about Gideon, Gideon has a concubine from Shechem who is clearly not an Israelite, and their child is Elimelech, who is Avimelech, who is a very problematic character. He kills all his brothers. He takes over from Gideon, and he is as opposite from Gideon as night and day. He's a very problematic character, and he is very connected to his mother's family in Shechem. Later on, when the splitting of the kingdom happens and Jeroboam comes and announces, you know, new kingdom, etc., where does that split take place? In Shechem. So Shechem is a scene of division. It's a scene of problematics. It's a scene of uneasy relationships between Israel and other nations. So if this interpretation works, it certainly fits into this idea of Shechem as we know it as a problematic place. Okay, so that's one interpretation. Now I'm going to go back to a different interpretation that I think is probably a little bit more conservative. I like them both, by the way, I like both interpretations. But the second interpretation is put forward by someone named Yael Ziegler. She is an amazing, also Bible teacher, very, very widely regarded here in Israel, and actually also in the United States. She's originally from the United States, and she's written books both in Hebrew and in English. Now, she says something different. She says, yeah, you know what? She says, this is a speech that was actually given, not at the end of Joshua's life, but much more, much earlier on. And you'll notice, whereas in chapter 23, it says when Joshua was old and well advanced in years, in chapter 24, it doesn't say anything about Joshua's age. She also notes that this takes place in Shechem. Where is Shechem? Shechem is the city right in between Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. And so she says what basically has happened. If you go back to Joshua chapter 8, what we studied about the covenant that took place in at Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, exactly as Moses commanded the nation in Deuteronomy 11. Here it takes place, and we learn about the building of the altar on Mount Ebal, and then the subsequent the subsequent covenant that's entered into there between the nation of Israel. And so what she's saying is this entire speech really happened there. This is the speech that Joshua addresses the entire nation. And it's not, even though it says the people, et cetera, instead of the nation, it is referring to the nation of Israel, the regular old nation of Israel, children of Israel. And he addresses them and he's telling them, and in fact, when we learn in Joshua 8, verse 32, it says, and there on the stones, he inscribed a copy of the teaching that Moses had written for the Israelites. And that finds its echo here in our chapter where Joshua says in verse 25, on that day at Shechem, Joshua made a covenant for the people. So this would not be a different covenant, but the same covenant. And Joshua recorded all this in a book of divine instruction. He took a great stone and set it up at the foot of the oak in the sacred precinct of the Lord. In other words, in both places, we have this inscription on a stone or on stones. What is this holy place then that Joshua is referring to, this temple or whatever? Now, there is an altar that is built at Mount Ebal. Okay, so it could be it's referring to the fact that this is an altar. It's a sacred place, not a temple, but the location of an altar, which could also be, you know, seen as a sacred place. And in fact, that altar was actually found. There is now on Mount Ebal, an archaeologist in Israel who has since passed away, his name is Adam Zartal, discovered that original altar. So that would be her interpretation. When she talks about referring to Terach, why going back to Terach? Why are we talking about removing your idols? And here, it's just very possible that maybe not necessarily physically that they have idols, but it's just a more extreme way of saying what Joshua has been saying before, don't be influenced. So it's like remove from you any even desire to have an idol, or maybe you've already picked one up along the way, you know, throw it away. You know, if they've picked up any booty or any loot along the way and something was an idol, maybe they like the gold of it, get rid of it. That could be what the interpretation is. And that's how she sees this. Now, it's definitely a more traditional approach. The only question, of course, that remains is if indeed this speech was delivered in chapter 8, why is it the final speech of the book of Joshua? And here she gives what I think is an excellent answer. And this is something that I know in the past when I've said something about moving things around, someone interpreted me as saying, oh, that, you know, this is kind of like, you know, Bible criticism that somebody came along and mixed things around. Absolutely not. What I'm referring to is a decision in prophecy, a God-driven decision. And when this book was written, okay, by Joshua, that there was this prophetic decision to put it here for its educational value. Yes, of course, it took place then. Why is it here? Because this is a lead-in to the book of Judges. The book of Judges, as we will see, is a tremendous decline, deterioration. We see the nation of Israel that is doesn't have effective leadership, that is immersed in the ways of the Canaanites, that is immersed in idol worship, and so many other things that go on. And so by putting this here, it's kind of saying to the nation, or in a very strong and powerful way, this is the covenant you signed up for. You agreed not to worship idols, but to stick with the Lord your God. And it kind of presents you there as this tremendous contrast with what was actually done as soon as we go into the book of Judges, which is, of course, the next chapter in this history. So those are the two explanations. You know, do with it what you like. I think they raise, in any case, excellent questions, and I hope you appreciate that. We'll just finish the end of the book now, basically sums it up. Joshua died at the age of 110. They buried him in a place called Timnat Serach, which is in the mountain of Ephraim. There is another place where this is called Timnat Cheres, I believe in Chronicles, and that's just reversing the two words. There is a village just north of Ariel that is called Kiful Cheres, and there is a place that is thought to be the tomb of Joshua. And that kind of makes sense because it is in the mountain of Ephraim. Anyway, we learn that Ephraim, this time of Joshua was a very good time, a very peaceful time. And we learn in verse 31, Israel served the Lord during the lifetime of Joshua and the lifetime of the elders who lived on after Joshua, and it would experience all the deeds that the Lord had wrought for Israel, which of course is in contrast what happens in the later generation once that generation dies out. We also learn that they buried Joseph's bones in Shechem, which is also an interesting connection, putting the speech here that takes place in Shechem and then noting here that they actually buried Joseph's bones there. And this is kind of a coming full circle. We learn at the end of the Exodus, just before they leave Egypt, Moses brings up the bones of Joseph and takes them with him. And here that comes full circle. So in a way, this verse kind of represents the conclusion of everything that began with the Exodus, and now a final conclusion with the burial of the bones, kind of saying, okay, everything is settled. Everybody's in the land. They're in their territory. They have settled. Even Joseph's bones have settled and been laid to rest in the land of Israel. Then the last verse is also about Eleazar, who was Aaron's heir. He was the next high priest. He also dies. And he is buried also in the mountain of Ephraim. And that's the end of the book. It's a wonderful book. I think with all there are some issues that take place in the book, but for the most part, Joshua refers to a time that was as close to ideal as you can get. Very little sin, great miracles, great accomplishments. They come into the land, they conquer it, they settle it. In these last chapters, there is a hint that we have a danger, we have a risk of leaving God, we have a risk of pagan worship, but the way Joshua ends, it is merely a threat for the future, not something that we have seen at all in the book of Joshua. We have finished Joshua, and we will meet to do Judges, but not until after Passover. I went longer than usual, but I had to finish the book, but now's a great time if you want to open your mics and ask any questions or make any comments. That's great.
Is it possible to summarize just briefly the two views?
The first view says that this talk was given in Shechem, primarily addressed to people who lived in Shechem that were not part of Israel, but through various circumstances had some sort of alliance with Israel. And Joshua is now saying to them, okay, guys, we have now conquered the land. We are here, but you can't continue to sit on the fence. You decide, are you going to be Canaanites or are you going to be part of Israel? Okay, that's the decision. First view.
Yeah.
And the second view is that this is a speech that Joshua makes to the nation of Israel, but it was not actually made here at the end of his life. It was made in chapter 8 as part of the covenant that takes place near right in Shechem, which is where Mount Ebal, Mount Gerizim, Shechem is in the middle, and that the reason it's put at the end of the book is because with its very stark warnings about getting rid of your pagan gods, etc., it leads you into where all that falls apart in the book of Judges.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions? Okay. So we will see you again at the end of April. I think it works out to be April 25th is going to be our next class. April 25th, we will start the book of Judges. And of course, we will send out a reminder email. We will be using the same Zoom link. So if you want to, I think we're using the same Zoom link.
Yes, actually, definitely. I don't know. Yeah, we'll use the same link. Absolutely.
Okay, so if you just want to keep that link, you'll know it'll be the same time as we've been doing it. Monday, 6:00 Israel time. And we will start the book of Judges on April 25th.
Wow.
Okay.
Meanwhile, Chag Sameach, yes?
Chag Sameach. Chag Sameach Pesach.
Thank you. Lots of work before we get there.
Chag Sameach Pesach.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that video. And we'd like to be sure you're getting all of our video content. So just click on the subscribe button below, as well as on the notification bell. And that way you will have easy access to all our material. We look forward to staying in touch with you. God bless you and have a wonderful day.